Lean Leadership Podcast, episode 65.
This is the Lean Leadership Podcast. Equip yourself with the tools for success in your team's lean journey by learning from the world's top lean professionals. Listen at the risk of improving with your host, Chris Burnham.
Today's guest is Hugh Alley. Hugh has a breadth of experience in helping organizations make measurable improvements in productivity, quality, and delivery, all of which help improve profitability. He also helps people become better leaders. His work has been improving operational performance in manufacturing, services, and the public sector. Hugh lives in Burnaby, British Columbia, and is very active in the continuous improvement and Kata community in the Cascadia region. Hugh is the author of Becoming the Supervisor, Productivity Press, June 2020, a story focused on developing the core skills of frontline leaders. Here's our guest, Hugh Alley. Hugh, we briefly touched on who you were in the intro, but can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and how lean and continuous improvement is a part of your life?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. It's great to be with you. I've had a long career in lean and in continuous improvement, but it didn't have that label when I got started. And so I've sort of stumbled into it, if you will. I started as an engineer and working with mining company on strategic planning, and have moved on through a host of industries. And everywhere I went, there were things that needed to be improved. And so I just kind of learned the tools as I needed to. And I had some good structure from my engineering degree, but frankly, the practical tools were things that I learned when I needed to.
Okay, that's great. And Hugh, where are you talking to us from today?
I am talking to you from Burnaby, British Columbia, which is a suburb of Vancouver.
Okay. I live in Memphis, Tennessee, so we're connected to Vancouver by way of an NBA basketball team. Our Memphis Grizzlies were once your Vancouver Grizzlies.
They were. We mourn their departure still.
That is a beautiful part of the world. I love the Vancouver area. I think it's just an incredible place. Vancouver, Washington, what the U.S. calls the Pacific Northwest. It's a beautiful part of the country.
It's hard to think of living anywhere else. And up here, we refer to it as Cascadia, which is kind of that British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, maybe stretching into Northern California, but that run of the Cascade Mountains, there's a lot of good feeling between the folks here, and I got tons of folks that I count as really good friends and right across the region.
That's great. Well, before we get started with our interview, we always like to ask our guests to share with us a quote or a mantra from a favorite leader of theirs. So can you tell us what your quote is and why you chose it?
Sure, Chris. I love the quote that without standards, there can be no improvement. And that is usually attributed to Taichi Ono, but I've seen it attributed to others. I think I've read it in Masaki Imai's book, Gemba Kaizen, and I've seen it in a host of different variations, you know, all the translation challenges. But the whole idea that without having a standard to measure against, something to compare to, you can't improve, I think is so critical and so little understood.
I love that. I agree with that. I think that having a standard is similar to having the beginning point when you're putting directions into your phone where you want to go somewhere to a destination. You have to start somewhere. And in order to navigate and appreciate the journey, you have to know from whence you came in order to get to where you're going.
You do. And the practical example that I think, and you probably get this living in Tennessee, is if you like barbecue, right, and you've got a sauce recipe, if you don't know what it is, If you don't know what you put in there, how could you make it better if you're just starting from scratch every time? You have to have that standard.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. I love the fact that you were able to work in a barbecue reference to Memphis before I was. I don't give out podcast points, but if I did, you would earn 10 of them.
That's
a great point, is that you can have different standards in different areas if they're different things, but you have to have a standard because that's the first version of the truth that everyone else works from.
Yeah, it's one of the things that's really fun to watch is in organizations where they haven't had any, and just the idea of, if it's in training within industry and using job instruction and developing that first job breakdown structure, and people say, well, that's not the way I did it, or I do it, and all of a sudden you get this conversation and discover that there are better ways to do things. Just putting a standard in place often will give you 10, 15, 20% improvement in the efficiency of a task. Just because you have the conversation.
Great points. Well, Hugh, one of my goals for this podcast is to help other lean leaders resonate with your experiences and your learning. So can you share with us kind of how or why you chose the profession that we're in now, where teaching and leading continuous improvement?
So, Chris, I don't know that I set out to have this career. I kind of stumbled into it, I think. I mentioned starting in mining, and I remember visiting a mine site early on in my career. And the mine manager and his planner were showing me the layout for this mine and where they were going to run the next tunnels. And so this is a potash mine. I don't know if you've ever had any experience with them, but the potash comes in layers. It's maybe 2 to 3 meters thick. And will run for miles, truly like hundreds of miles. And so they're just running out as long as is efficient, and then they come back mining stope after stope. And I looked at the layout in one place and I said, so why is it that here you're running this stope only 500 meters when you have told me that the ideal distance is about 2 meters or 2 kilometers. And they said, well, it's just, where this other intervening transfer conveyor works, that's what's left. And I said, so why wouldn't you move where the transfer conveyor is? Like, it doesn't matter. You just put in a little bit more and move the transfer conveyor once, and now you've got the adits running, or the stopes running full length. And they went, oh, yeah, we could do that. They'd run into their property line and they stopped. That one question saved them $1 million a year. And, I didn't know anything about potash mining at that point, but I just kind of asked a question that seemed like a reasonable one to me. And my goodness, it made a difference. And so that sort of curiosity and asking questions was fun. And I kept doing it.
I love that story. It's that most of the, I would say the best improvements start with someone who's not familiar with your process and asks, why do you do it that way?
Yeah.
And oftentimes the answer you get is, I don't know. I've never thought of it that way. Because we tend to become nose blind to our process and not think of that we're just doing things the way that we've always done them, because we're getting results that are, while they may be you know, not the most efficient, but they're okay. They're satisfactory. And by making one small little change, you can have a step function and improvement.
You bet. Yeah.
So that's a great story of just asking a question, $1 million of savings. There have to be moments where it wasn't that easy, where there was a setback with lean or continuous improvement. Can you share with our listeners any pitfalls or mistakes that you've gone through in your career and what you learned from those experiences?
Sure. Yeah. So the place that I really cut my teeth in terms of learning lean and the practical stuff of making it happen was in a company that made aluminum railing systems. And I was the operations manager. I started with them in the fall of 2007. And you may recall that 2008, the bottom fell out of the economy. And we were providing construction materials. And all of a sudden, 25% of our market disappeared. And so we had to do a whole lot of stuff to just to kind of survive. And we did a lot of things right. We got 10% a year productivity gains. We had a shift in the culture of the place that had us go from zero ideas from employees to we were seeing one or two implemented a week. And I didn't even know about half of them until they were reported because we'd pushed the responsibility down far enough. They knew they had the authority. Just make it happen if it makes sense. And so there were a lot of really good things that happened there. But what I didn't do in that place is my job was operations manager. I did not push for the same kind of rigor on the sales side of the organization. And when I look back on it, that was just so blind of me because we were like, we cut. So this was, it was when I started there, it was a $20 million organization. We cut $1.5 million out of the operating overhead of that company in a year and a half. That was a huge amount of the overhead just gone. And the place ran just fine because we'd figured out how to do things and we pushed stuff down into the plant where it belonged and lots of good stuff. But we didn't deal with the sales side. And so we didn't, you know, the salespeople were left to their own devices and they would just kind of throw up their hands, it's the economy. And I'm thinking, no, it can't be just the economy. We got people here whose work lives depend on you guys selling stuff. And unfortunately, the company eventually went bankrupt, went under. The good side was that the carcass was bought by a company that was in the business and most of the operation side, which was actually running pretty well by that time, most of them wound up with jobs in the successor, which was good. Painful for me, expensive for me. I just chalked, that was my MBA. but I learned you cannot be sort of just focused on the operations piece.
That's a great experience there of understanding that an enterprise end to end is from raw materials all the way through to delivery to customer, and that sales is a key component of that. And that when you're mapping out your value stream or you're mapping out your value delivery mechanism, you have to remember that piece. Otherwise, you're just sub-optimizing an area and you're getting these little islands of optimization that fight against one another and actually create more tension in the organization than you would get from looking at an enterprise end-to-end improvement methodology.
Yeah.
Well, there has to be a moment, and you may have shared with us already. I mean, you've already shared a story about how one question generated $1 million in savings, but there has to be an aha moment with your lean or continuous improvement journey. Can you share with us the story about that experience?
Yeah, I did some work, and they're okay about me using the name of the company. So it's a company in rural Alberta. So think north of Idaho, north of Wyoming. And they make mixers for dairy cattle feed. So, you know, put in a bunch of hay, put in a bunch of vitamins and whatever else you've got going, and you get it all mixed together. So it's an even mix of food for your cows. And they make fabulous equipment that they ship all over the world. When I started with them, I was working for a consulting firm at the time, and the challenge that they were running into is that they had a 6-month lead time. So they were the worst in the industry, and it was starting to cost them sales. People would say, you know, love your machines, happy to pay your prices, but I can't wait 6 months. And so, okay, what can we do about it? And I went in, and over the course of 8 months, we did a bunch of stuff around just unplugging things, paying attention to where the bottleneck was, and paying attention to the sales process, and you know, where can we take the guck out of that process, and developing the skills of the frontline leaders. And over the course of 8 months, their lead time went from 6 months to 6 weeks. In that 8 months, they'd gone from the worst in the industry to the best in the industry. They had put $1 million in cash into the company, like reduced their working capital by $1 million. They had fundamentally doubled the output rate of the plant. And the total capital they'd spent was $25,000 for some welders, welding machines. It's like, that's a gimme. It was so neat to watch how excited they were at the improvement stuff. And you know, I'm still in touch with those folks today, you know, still with the president, but also with the supervisors. And, you know, we're in touch back and forth. And in my book, I actually dedicate one of the folks that I dedicate the book to is one of the guys there, because Derek just blossomed. I tell the story, and as he told me, he got his job as a supervisor because he didn't step back fast enough. Like he didn't want the job. And I remember the first time I met him, he had a dismal morning meeting with his crew, and he didn't know what to do. And so he went back to the line and picked up the welding torch. 8 months later, the meeting was crisp, and his crew knew what they were, their priorities, and he'd made some changes about the sequence because there were some changes that some of the guys had identified. And then he said, okay, now what I've got is I've got 3 improvement projects I'm working on. And he was focused on making stuff better. And, you know, to watch Derek just blossom like that, that was so awesome.
All right. So you've teased our podcast audience. For the folks that are listening, if you could tell them about the book, and for the folks that are watching, if you could show them what the book looks like so that go to order it, they make sure they're ordering the right one.
So this is what it looks like. It's called Becoming the Supervisor. And it's written as a story about a young guy who's just struggling as a thrust into the role of supervisor, as so many are. And but the guts of the book is how a new general manager coaches him into the skills that he needs to be a competent supervisor. So it's very much use the problems that are in front of you approach, rather than saying, this is your curriculum. Well, the first thing that happens in the story is somebody quits. So, you know, those one of those jackknife guys who can do everything, he quits, and now he's stuck. And so, okay, well, you better learn how to train somebody. And that's how it gets going.
Yeah, it's interesting because I became an operations manager that same way. Is that someone left the company, they retired, and they say, hey, congratulations. I'm like, whoa, I'm not equipped to do that. And they said, no, but you are, because you are our program manager and you understand the customer and you understand the process from end to end. And people like you. Like you're a likable person. And I went through a learning curve where I wasn't liked so much. And then I had a good leader behind me that said, go back to who you were. Like, go back to the basics and just do these basic things and ask these questions every day and just listen to your people. And it made a tremendous, it changed my career, changed my life. And it improved not only for me, but for the people I worked with every day. It made everything easier at work. So I'm glad you share a story about how a leader who we learn from about leading is almost as important about how we learn to lead.
Yeah, absolutely. And at one level, you know, I think when I think about what is somebody moving into that role need, I mean, there's a gazillion things you need, but I think you can boil it down to, if somebody can master, or not even master, if they can be good journey people, good journeyman skills in five things, that's enough. They need to be able to instruct. They need to be able to foster performance. They need to be able to make improvements. They need to be able to set priorities, and they need to be able to listen. And if you can do those five things, even passably well, you can be a pretty good supervisor. And they're all learnable, and that's the exciting thing.
That's great. We're going to talk a little bit about the book later on in the podcast episode, but I'm glad you brought it up now. Hugh, you've seen a lot of things in your career as an operations manager, an industrial engineer, a consultant. There has to be a lean or continuous improvement. I don't know if pet peeve is the right word, but something that you frequently see being applied or done wrong. Can you share with us what the thing is that you commonly observe and just tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. I think, it's a broad thing, Chris. I think that the most common mistake I see is that people get caught in the intricacies of using the particular tool that they're interested in, rather than paying attention to the mindset of being curious about being experimenting and trying to solve the business problem. If we think about it, so many of these lean tools got noticed when they were brought back from Toyota, amongst other companies, but Toyota was a big part of it. And we forget that nobody sat down in the boardroom of Toyota in 1953 and said, let's create the Toyota production system, right? No, those guys, they were just trying to solve a cash flow problem, right? It was like, how are we going to pay for the steel to make the next car? Well, we better get the material that's here out. How can we do that faster? And that was their problem. And that's what they were working on. And so 5S didn't start as a system. Let's invent a system for keeping the workplace clean. No, they were solving a problem that was slowing people down. So they said, well, let's get rid of the stuff that's not here and put the stuff that we need close. Good. Well, can we do it more? Yes, let's do it. Oh, it's not going so well. Well, how can we keep it stable? How can we systemize it? They were just solving one problem after another and putting processes in place. And so it's not about saying, we are going to do 5S, right? Okay, maybe, but that might not be the right solution for the problem that you're facing. And so folks that get caught in the tools, that's my pet peeve.
Yeah, I completely resonate with the story that you're sharing there. And also, when people are tool focused, they expect that, oh, I just install this tool and everything magically goes away or magically improves. And I tell folks, Toyota has been doing this for nearly 100 years, and they're still not where they want to be. They're still finding things. They're still improving things. So yeah, that's why we talk about it's a journey. It's not like, hey, we'll be where we need to be in 3 to 6 months. No, you have to understand the problems and the mindset that and the observation skills that support the behaviors and principles that support the tool in its use, but that sometimes if you apply the principles correctly, you may realize you're using the wrong tool together. Like you're not solving the problem the right way.
Yeah. And that's okay, because most of the time we don't know how to solve the problem, right? So it's all an experiment. And, you know, as long as we're willing to say, that's not working the way, you know, we were expecting this and we did this, and it's not playing out the way we were expecting. So what's different? What don't we understand that would cause us to think about, well, maybe there's something else we can do?
Yeah. The heart of Kata is run the experiment. Let's go learn. Let's go discover something new that we can apply to our knowledge so that we can improve things. It's what I love about that system and the methodology behind it. That's supported by those principles. But that's also why you can't just go out and say, hey, we're going to do Kata. Like you have to learn how to coach. You have to have a coach that can help you coach. And you have to be a learner first in order to be successful with it.
You bet.
Well, Hugh, what do you consider the most important thing that you've learned in your career journey so far?
I'll go to one of two directions, and I'm not sure what's the most important. But one of them is keep the business problem in front of you, right? And it goes back to what I had just been saying, is you need to remember that we're in this to deliver value to our customer. And there's something currently standing in the way of doing that the way the customer's looking for. So keep that business problem in front of you as you're working on all these other things, because it gives you context. In the world of Toyota Kata, it's that challenge that you're constantly referencing of, okay, is this next target condition actually helping me get there? Is this next experiment helping me move toward in that direction? But it gives clarity to your team if they're very clear about the business problem that you've identified and saying, this is what we got to solve in the next month, 6 months, whatever your period of time is. That makes it practical for your people. It's no longer just, oh, we've got to get X much more revenue. No. The issue is there's a significant part of the market out there that doesn't even know about us. So what do we need to do to solve that problem? Because our solution, our product, our service would help them.
Great. And when you go back to like thinking how you apply that that career knowledge, what piece of advice would you give to someone who's just starting out with lean or continuous improvement?
Go and watch. Right?
That's it. Like just go for a walk, right?
No, it's not go for a walk. It's go and watch. Because what happens is as if you're still walking, you're not actually paying attention to the detail of what's happening in that location. And I'm working with a client right now, and I said, you know, told them, look, go out and stand there, tell the guys what you're doing, and watch the process for an hour. And they came back and they said, I had no idea how much variation there was. Right? Opportunity staring them in the face, and just for an hour of going and watch. And it's a tool that's wildly underrated and underused.
I love that. In the past, when I would go and observe direct observation, which my mentor said, those two initials mean do, like D-O, direct observation. When you go do something that, and you're taking notes, make sure to tell them, you know, what you talked about. Hey, I'm over here. This is what I'm doing. I'm going to be writing some things down. If you want to look at what I'm writing down and tell me what I'm missing, have at it. Like, just be transparent about that. And man, I had folks come in, hey, what are you writing there? Oh yeah. Well, did you see this over here? And the experts at the front line become the instructors at that point. They're excited that someone is paying attention to what they are doing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then it becomes so much easier to make the changes because they've already been part of the conversation. You say, I was looking at it and wondering about doing this. What do you think? And it won't work that way. And okay, what can we do to make it work? And then they get involved. It's just fun then.
Well, what piece of advice would you give to someone who's a little bit further along in their career? Maybe something someone shared with you recently or something you learned recently.
And I'm still learning this. Say less.
Not when you're on a podcast interview, but yeah.
No. Okay. So not on the podcast interview, but you know, I'm doing a lot more coaching now, and the ability to say something and then stop soon enough that I let the learner think and then respond, and giving them time to be comfortable to allow the silence to sit while they think. Because it's interesting when you do that, they eventually realize, well, he's waiting for me to say something. And they will. And as they talk themselves into learning stuff, which is pretty cool.
I think there's power in the pause, in sense of it's empowering. It's giving someone space to think and reflect before they answer the question. One of the things that I've learned that goes along with that is when someone asks me a question that's thought-provoking, I'm just saying, I need to reflect on that a second. And, mm-hmm. and that shows, A, that respect that you're engaged and you're listening to what they're saying, but then also it's warming up the engines. It's, you know, it's a little bit of reflection before projection. And you tend to have better answers when you engage your mind a little bit faster than you engage your vocal abilities. Yeah. Well, other than becoming a supervisor, do you have a favorite book, author, or mentor that you would recommend to our listeners?
I think I'll point at three, Chris. One is Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why, because it really gets at the whole idea that people need a sense of purpose. They need to, I think most people want to be part, they want to do something that matters. And you know, it doesn't matter whether they're welding little fittings together that will hold the end of a piece of railing, and you got to weld it well enough to keep the kids safe, or whether it's, you know, you're working for a company that is building electric cars and going to change the world, you know, that way. But you need to have a sense of purpose. So that's the first one. The second one is just really practical. Mike Rother's book, the Toyota Kata practice guide, essential reading, I think. And the other one is, will feel like it's a little bit off in left field. It's a book called Who by Jeff Smart and Randy Street. And it's about how to hire people. And what they get at is that you really need to be looking for fit with the organization. And they give you some really practical ideas about how to look for that. I don't buy everything that they've written, but I think it's a really useful introduction to that whole world of how do you go find people and how do you bring them, select them and bring them on board. And in today's world, that's a big deal.
Yes, it is. And it's changed dramatically in the last 18 to 24 months too, on how we attract and retain and train high performers within our organizations.
Yeah. And I think one of the pieces that most people have underestimated is that there's not actually a shortage, at least in my view, there's not a shortage of skilled people. There's a shortage of skilled supervisors. Because,
well,
there, you know, you think about it, every company is unique. You're not going to be able to hire the skills you need off the street. So you need leaders who can train people to do what they need to do.
That's so powerful, because I think along the lines of that, I know of an organization where they had an open position for a frontline leader, and they held it open until they had the right person for that mm-hmm. role, rather than just filling that role with the first person that came along, or the best they could do at that moment. It was yes. understanding the standard that you were setting, and sometimes having the position open is easier than having it's a lot easier than having the wrong person in that position, because having the wrong person cool. in that position can do a lot more damage to the organization.
Yeah. And I saw a lovely quote the other day that if the position has been open for 6 months and you're still operating fine, then you should be promoting, not hiring.
Fair enough. Well, you and I both know in our experiences that magic wands don't exist, but if Shucks. They did,
I'm disappointed. And you could fix it.
Yeah. So Harry Potter fans are disagreeing with me right now, but yeah. in the world that we exist, they don't exist. And if you had one and you could fix anything with a facility or a group that you were coaching, what would you typically wave that wand at first?
I would look at two things. I'd want to understand what the customers are complaining about, because that at the end of the day, they're paying the check. They're writing the check. So I want to know what's biggest on their minds and fix that. The other thing that is critical internally is to move the organization from blame to curiosity.
Great advice. And a unique way, that's the first time we've had the voice of the customer incorporated into the answers for that question in the podcast. So thank you for sharing that. Hugh, talk to us about your book, Becoming a Supervisor. Can you share with readers kind of, we want them to go buy the book to learn more, but
oh, yeah.
What can they expect when they pick up the book?
It's a fun story, in my view, just because the setting is kind of fun. It's a toy boat factory, right? They make wooden toy boats. But the problems that Trevor, the lead character, runs into are things that everyone's going to see. You know, people quitting and now you're short staff. You got a quality problem, you know, shipping problems. You have people not showing up for work. You have issues with departments fighting each other. And those become the fodder for the learning. So the story's engaging. What I think, several people have told me that the at the end of each chapter, there are reflection questions, which help you sort of think about, okay, how does this work in my place? And several people have told me that those have been super helpful. And then on the book's website, which is becoming thesupervisor.com, there's a whole bunch of downloadable forms and resources that they're pulled from directly from the book. But anybody who's used the training within industry model will recognize all this stuff. I mean, it's not rocket science. I'm not inventing everything. What I was aware of is that there was nothing in the market that would either encourage a new supervisor that this is a learnable skill, or that would encourage the manager of supervisors that this stuff is trainable. You can take these skills and build them in your supervisors. And I think that's, if we're trying to make good work lives for people, and I think that's an important thing, you know, I think people deserve good work, then having great supervisors really matters.
Well, we will put links to on how to get becoming the supervisor in the show notes page here after the episode. Hugh, how can people connect with you if they want to learn more about what you do, or if they have a question for you on something that we spoke about today?
Chris, the easiest way is hugh@becomingthesupervisor.com.
Okay, well, we will absolutely put that link in the show notes page. Hugh, thank you for the work that you're doing for the Lean community and your contributions to making workplaces a better place for people to lead and work in. And I'm grateful that we finally got an opportunity to meet.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, Chris. I've appreciated the time.
Well, I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
You bet. Thanks.
I want to thank Hugh for being a guest on the podcast today. Be sure to go to the show notes page at leanleadershippodcast.com and check out the links to learn more about Hugh and how to connect with him if you have a question about what we talked about today. As always, I welcome your feedback on how to improve the podcast. If you like the podcast, make sure to go to podchaser.com/leanleadershippodcast and leave a rating for the podcast. Thank you for listening, and until next time, seek progress over perfection.
Thanks for listening to the Lean Leadership Podcast with Chris Burnham. Get more info, resources, tools, or connect at leanleadershippodcast.com.